Even that famous like hitchhiking scene, I feel like wouldn't be allowed in the cut when she, you know, sticks her leg out and pulls her skirt all the way up.
That wouldn't be.
That's pretty racy.
It's really, that really does it for Thomas.
Just saying, you got to watch out.
Hi, and welcome to Episode Cine Nation. I am Brandon Sparks.
And I'm Ben Gertz.
And I'm Thomas Horton.
And with each episode of Cine Nation, we pick a subgenre of film. We delve into kind of the history and the tropes. And so each week we pick a new topic. And for example, this week we're doing screwball comedy. But before we delve into that, I want to do a brief follow-up to a couple of the last podcast episodes we've done. Orson Welles is becoming a big theme here, guys. I have a thing I want to talk about Orson Welles real quick. But it also kind of goes with our topic a little bit. So I was watching a really good film noir recently called Murder, My Sweet. I try to watch a movie now and then watch the commentary right after.
Ah, interesting.
And so I was watching this. It was a 1940s movie called Murder, My Sweet with Dick Powell. It's an adaptation of a Raymond Chandler novel, Farewell, My Lovely. And so basically it's following Philip Marlowe, the detective. And when I was listening to the commentary, they picked this like kind of film historian to talk about it. What's interesting that I never knew, because I always knew film noir came from the French and looking at like the type of work that was coming out of Hollywood at that time. What I didn't realize was how much World War II affected it, and how the reason why they kind of came, it became very specific of what they were calling this genre, was because during the war, none of the films went over to France because there was like an embargo to where they weren't coming over. And so once the war was over, they just had a bunch of these films come in at the same exact time. And so the French critics like Truffaut and Godard were all seeing these films happening at the same exact time and seeing all the similarities between them. And that's kind of how the genre of film noir came to be. Like,
meaning that the French critics there was an embargo in France, so all of a sudden they got a whole series of American films, like 3 or 4 years worth of American films.
Yes.
And they picked up on the themes that then the French turned into film noir, or that's not what you're saying?
No, that's what I'm saying, yeah. Okay. It was like they were seeing the similarities in style and tone and theme, and how they realized it was kind of this movement that was happening. And it's like when you're watching it all like separately, when you're being thrown all these different movies every year in America, you're not seeing all that because they're like being separated by months or sometimes years. And within France, what was happening, it seemed like they were getting it all at the same exact time. And that's what helped them see what America was doing during the war period and how the war was affecting what movies they were putting out. Which is, it's interesting because you're basically seeing the context of the past, but putting it in a more current perspective, at least just a few years later. But to bring up the Orson Welles thing, because Murder, My Sweet was done by RKO, and RKO also released Citizen Kane, and what the historian was talking about was that literally after Citizen Kane, RKO started changing how they made films from a stylistic perspective because of what Orson Welles did with Citizen Kane. So they're saying how in certain scenes in Murder, My Sweet, you're seeing all these different, like, ceiling shots, because Welles was known for like shooting very low angles to see the ceiling, and how the historian was saying was that literally if you start watching all these RKO films at the time, you start seeing a lot of these shots happening, and it's all because of what Welles was doing with what he did with Kane. But the reason why I wanted to be at film noir, because the same exact time of film noir that was happening, you start getting screwball comedy, and there's been kind of parallels between the two genres, I think, as time has gone on. They both kind of started happening during Depression, war era, and they somehow fizzled out in the 50s and 60s, but they're still kind of occurring today in some way.
And still extremely influential.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I mean, I was hearing, like, the new Chris Pine, Patty Jenkins TV show or a limited series on
I Am the Night.
I heard Chris Pine talk about how like Patty Jenkins pitched it as like a film noir in LA, and that was the style they were going for. I think people are going back and looking at that in some way and seeing how it can influence more modern cinema.
Mm-hmm.
But with screwball comedies, it's starting to kind of take shape again with, I think, because screwball comedy is essentially it is still a romantic comedy, just a different, it's a subgenre of that genre.
Yeah.
But what the big kind of, the hard part, because screwball comedy, it feels like it can be a hard definition to nail down. Because we were kind of discussing it before the show, like, what do you guys consider a screwball comedy? Like, what kind of fits as a definition?
I mean, I think when you guys first said this was going to be our topic, the thing that came to mind for me really is just that, like, fast-paced, witty banter, right? Like, which you get in rom-coms, but I think the screwball element is just, like, the pace is so much faster, and it's so much about both characters, but especially the female character, the female lead, being really sharp, right? Because you can have rom-coms that are just two idiots, and that's not what comes to mind necessarily, for me at least, for a screwball.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting for a lot of people. I've been talking about this episode, getting ready for it, and a lot of people have never even heard the term screwball comedy, but once you start talking about kind of the originals, they all know exactly what you're talking about, and exactly, you know, even if they never had a name for it, they knew that there was something that set these movies apart from your standard romantic comedy. And I mean, the classics, I think, that come to mind, and this will be interesting to kind of, because I feel like each of these classics you can kind of pick apart to see their influence on the genre and their influence on romantic comedies in general. But I think you're talking It Happened One Night, Bringing Up Baby, and His Girl Friday, maybe My Man yeah. Godfrey, if you yeah. make it four, but mm-hmm. I think those three or four are really, you know, what it boils down to as they are all kind of different. They all introduce kind of different tropes of the genre,
yeah,
in different ways. But they all kind of, if you look at those as a group, I think they all contain the basic elements of what you need for one of these movies.
Yeah, and I think too, because again, we're talking about how screwball comedy came out during the Depression. A big theme, which is present in a couple of these films you're talking about, is class difference and mm-hmm. class struggle. And with It Happened One Night, there's kind of been a few things before that, but they were both in. It Happened One Night was in 1934, so it's in that midst of like it's pre-code and mm-hmm. post-code. And for those who don't know what the
code, let's define that for folks.
What the code is. Basically, pre-code, there was...
The production code.
Yeah, the production code. It was the Hays Code. And so in pre-code Hollywood, it's post-silent film era and pre just like your standard Hollywood studio thing. And so basically, you're seeing a lot more violence, a lot more sexual innuendo, some profanity, drug use, prostitution, infidelity. Like, it's kind of a gamut of like everything that's like seen as like... immoral in a way.
I mean, even nudity, like people don't think about it these days, but if you go back to pre-code films, there was like nudity on film, and then it completely went away with the Hays Code.
This is my whole idea of like with cinema at this time, is that every time the filmmakers master this specific era, something gets thrown in to like push them back. So it's like two steps forward, three steps back. Once the silence, they'd really developed how to make silent films, sound comes in and like pushes everything backwards, and they have to relearn filmmaking. Pre-code is very similar because now they have to think more about what they're writing because they have to abide by what the code is saying. And what the Hays Code was is that it was put in place to where the government wouldn't censor movies that were coming out. So it was yeah. the self-censorship that was happening.
Right. Congress was threatening to start regulating films more heavily, and the studios yes. got together and agreed, like, we don't actually want the government to do this. We'll self-censor, and we'll handle our own business, basically. But, you know, it's definitely... I mean, I don't think we have the specifics here in the notes, but, like, very conservative, right? Just broadly yeah. speaking, like
it was like for example, for those that have seen Casablanca, spoiler if you haven't, I'm sorry, if that's on you. like the ending is that Ingrid Bergman's character Elsa does not go off with Humphrey Bogart, even though they're in this like love affair. She goes off with her husband, and if you knew about what the code was, you would know that in any Hollywood movie, a wife cannot leave her husband. or they can't separate, like, she basically, a wife can't leave the husband at the end. So she was never going to leave Bogart, or leave with Bogart because of what this code was. Or it's the thing of they don't want, like, the beds together or whatever. So in a lot of these films,
they can't sleep in the same bed.
They can't sleep in the same bed. So, and that brings up, it happened one night, even though it's still considered a pre-code era for some reason, which I'm not entirely sure why, because I think it probably was released right before the code came in. Yeah, that's what it was. So the motion picture,
even that famous hitchhiking scene, I feel like wouldn't be allowed in the code when she, you know, sticks her leg out and pulls her skirt all the way up.
That wouldn't be.
That's pretty racy.
It's really, that really does it for Thomas.
Just saying, you gotta watch out.
Who? No, yeah. So it was released 4 months before the code started being enforced. So it's like kind of, it helped start this genre in a way before the genre became, like, some people say the screwball comedy is direct workaround of what the code is. So it's, they, yeah. Someone defined, Andrew Saris, a critic, defined screwball comedies as a sex comedy without the sex.
Yeah, I thought that was really interesting from the notes, reading through and prepping, right? Idea that basically, like you're saying, like this is purely directors trying to work within this new constraint that doesn't really make sense. And then, you know, so yeah, there's basically the idea that the witty banter replaces what would be basically sexual tension. Physical tension is replaced with sort of this verbal banter. I thought that was really interesting, and it's cited, maybe I'm stealing your thunder here, Brandon, but it's like, it's cited as, you know, the code going away is sort of cited as like the decline of the subgenre, right?
Yeah. And also I think a lot of it with World War II is that screwball comedies were this big, and the Depression was this big statement on class struggle. And then once the Great Depression ended, class struggle was still a big deal in America, but not as much because the Depression was over. And so more people are wealthier than they were before. So I think that had to do with it. But then, yeah, when the code went out, it became where you could be very open with the things you were doing. But like there was a movie I was watching. Oh gosh, it was just like yesterday. I've watched so many screwball comedies, guys, in the past 2 days just to prep for this. It was Easy Living. And so Easy Living is basically this character is played by Jean Arthur. She is of a lower class or whatever. And just a random thing, it's kind of a farce in a way, is that she's on a bus and someone throws this mink coat off like the high tower, like the skyscraper apartment complex or whatever. And this mink coat falls on her, and this just kind of changes her entire life for a bit because people start seeing her as like, oh, she has a mink coat, she must be rich, and so she starts getting free stuff. And there's a scene when she's with a guy played by Ray Milland, and they literally had to determine, because they're laying on a bed or they're laying on like a couch together, and they had to be very specific of where the placement was to where it met with like code standards, because they couldn't have them like touching in any like major way because they weren't married, they weren't together. And that was the thing with the majority of these.
I mean, it
kind of
reminds you too of like today, like 2019, you know, late night hosts like Colbert will make a joke and then it's clearly a thinly veiled innuendo. And he's like, we can say that? We can say that? Is that going to go out? You know what I mean? There's clearly people off in the wing, right, who are like reviewing, and then they, you know, it's not live most of the time, so they edit it out if they need to. But it's fascinating that we still have some of these things, right? I mean, it was way stricter. But I think we all kind of take for granted that like, oh yeah, you know, Colbert and Jimmy Fallon and all these guys, like they can't, all these hosts, you know, they can't just say anything because they're at least the guys who are the people who are on, you know, the major ABC, NBC, all that stuff.
Well, there's that scene that I always think is hilarious. I mean, it's an extremely well done romantic scene, but in Hitchcock's Notorious, because the one of the rules in the Hays Code was you couldn't kiss for longer than 3 seconds. So Hitchcock does this extended makeout sequence between Cary Grant and
Ingrid Bergman.
Yes, Ingrid Bergman. And they're just making out all across the room, stumbling everywhere, but every 3 seconds they'll stop kissing and have a line and then go back to kissing again for 3 seconds and stop and have a line. And it's genius. And it's all done in like one shot, and he's following them around and the camera's just moving all around them. And you can just tell he was on set like, yeah, I got you. Somebody can sit there with a stopwatch and be like, all right, break and line and kiss and break.
Yeah.
But that's what it was, is that these directors were like, once they realized what the code was, they start figuring out ways around it, so you start getting better films. And that's present through, like, it's always interesting when you're starting from the beginning of a genre, or just film in general, and start working your way through, because you start seeing them develop these skills of how to work their way around it.
Mm-hmm. So let's go back and talk about kind of these kind of core...
Yeah.
Movies in the genre. So we were talking about It Happened One Night, which quickly is Claudette Colbert and Clark Gable. And she's rich and has run off and married a man that she wasn't supposed to marry. And her father has tried to separate them. And she's run away to go be with her new husband. Meanwhile, Clark Gable is a very poor and down on his luck reporter and realizes who she is while they're traveling together cross country, and basically they have to like basically offers to help her, but more like blackmails her that if he doesn't get to travel with her and write her story, that he'll rat her out to her dad. So there's that kind of opposites attract that we've talked about within this genre. There's the class difference for sure. She's upper class and he's very low class. And then there's that extremely visual tension between the two of them. There's the very famous what they call the Walls of Jericho, which is where they agree to share hotel rooms every night, but hang a bed sheet between the two of them as they're sharing a bed. But a lot of very classic scenes in there, and definitely one of the earlier films that is often cited within the genre of that kind of dialogue, you know, starting with the two of them hating each other, a very headstrong female character, and both of them pretty is, I mean, especially for a film in 1934 and a Frank Capra film, which Frank Capra is often seen as very sentimental, but it's got a fairly cynical, you know, stance towards love through the whole thing. Even when, once these two get together, it's not, you know, happily ever after kind of thing. It's neither of them are extremely romantic.
Yeah. And that's kind of another thing I read with screwball comedies, that it's a romantic comedy that's poking fun at romance in a way.
Right.
So it's almost a parody of its own genre.
Yeah, but it is basically that they all, like, the characters think that love is ridiculous or romance,
yeah,
or whatever, but then it is still two people falling in love, basically. You, mm-hmm, know, that's the, yeah. It's just I guess that's the, what is the actual, where does screwball, is that the idea that it's basically a twist on a rom-com?
So what I was watching the Palm Beach Story by Preston Sturges, and one of the good special features on it was another film historian, and he was talking about, his name's James Harvey, yes, and he was talking about how basically the term screwball came from like unconventional. With most screwball comedies, it focused on these two lovers that were unconventional in some way. And it could be like, one could be an alcoholic. One could be, with Bringing Up Baby, it's like, she's a very eccentric character, and they're like, they own is it a leopard or a cheetah? What is it they have?
Baby is, I think it's a leopard, right?
Leopard, yeah. And so basically it's like Katharine Hepburn and Cary Grant is this paleontologist and very...
bookish and very awkward
in a way. Like, they're talking about how they switch kind of the gender roles in a way, is that she's this free spirit, eccentric, kind of liberal in what she's doing, and he's this more straight-laced, conservative, like uptight human being. I mean, like, stereotypes for the time is what I'm saying, And
I mean, it's like, extremely groundbreaking. I mean, this woman meets this guy and says, I mean, doesn't say it out loud, but you can just see her say to herself. I mean, he like early on in their meeting tells her that he's engaged, and you can just see on her face like that's not going to happen. And just sets, and it's you know, it's things that at the time you're very used to seeing men do, seeing this woman and saying, well, she's going to end up with me by the end of this movie. But to see Katharine Hepburn kind of look this nerdy, awkward man up and down and decide, I'm going to win this guy over by the end of this movie was huge.
And so, yeah, it was like, it's taking this unconventional way of everything. And that's where the screwball comes in. And that was also directed by Howard Hawks, who is kind of seen as like one of the main directors of this genre. And he kind of had this known thing of like the Hawksian woman. And it's this woman who's almost independent, who is seen as an equal in a male dominated world. And she's one who could be, is smart, intelligent, witty, and is seen as one of the boys, but also doesn't lose her like seductive, like sexual ways. And it was very progressive for that time. And it's present through majority of his films, Howard Hawks' films, within the screwball genre and with his other films outside of that. So Thomas, what were some other movies you want to talk about? We talked about Happen One Night.
Definitely His Girl Friday, I think, to go off of what you're talking about with the kind of character Hawks, because it's also directed by Hawks, with Cary Grant again, but with Rosalind Russell. And I think what His Girl Friday takes, what he hit on with Bringing Up Baby, with that extremely strong Katharine Hepburn character, and then also has Cary Grant be her intellectual equal. And I think His Girl Friday really stands out when you're talking about all the different aspects of this genre. I think banter is really where His Girl Friday shines, because you have two people who are smarter than everyone else in the room the entire movie. And it's really interesting to watch that movie and to watch the way they interact with everyone else who's in that movie with them, because it is really just between the two of them. And they know anytime someone else is in the room, both of them know that they're smarter than that person, especially her fiance. And that it's the connection between the two of them is incredible. And that's that kind of thing where you're talking about like banter is like foreplay in this thing. I mean, it's like these two people are basically the only people in the room, despite all these other reporters and policemen and criminals being around. It's just always the two of them engaged in this like huge mental battle about whether or not she's going to quit working in his newspaper.
And two things off that, like, for one, we're talking about this like major female presence where they're equal. And to put that in perspective, His Girl Friday is actually a remake of another movie called The Front Page. And the two leads were two males, and they switched it and made it a former couple. So
that's interesting.
So like Rosalind Russell is literally playing a role that was originated by a male, and they gender swapped a character and add this whole new dynamic to it, but also not changing the placement of where they were. Like, one was not above the other, like what Thomas is saying.
Right.
And then another thing too, which is a big trope of screwball comedies, is this idea of remarriage, like breaking apart and coming back together, is that Rosalind Russell and Cary Grant are a former couple, or they married is what it was before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they're now divorced. And then she's now she's engaged to another man. And so the whole idea is like, oh, like we're not going to get back together, whatever. And then usually with a lot of these films, the characters come back around and remarry or become reacquainted or something. And that was a major thread of that era of screwball in the 30s and 40s. And by the end of it, we're actually starting to poke fun at it, it feels like, in the mid-40s.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting when you look at, and this is what I think is going to be really cool in this episode, is kind of, now that we've got kind of your basic, you know, the class differences, the stronger women, the banter, the remarriage, the comedy of divorce, the remarriage. One that came up in 1940 is The Philadelphia Story, which interestingly creates a love triangle invoking two of those different things. You've got, obviously, Katharine Hepburn is the extremely strong female character, and then Jimmy Stewart is in love with Katharine Hepburn, and he is kind of this lowly reporter who is just in awe of her social station in life. And then you've also got Cary Grant as her ex-husband, and you're creating a love triangle between the three of them and invoking all of these different themes of the screwball comedy.
Mm-hmm. And he is a wealthier class as well. Yeah. And then Stewart not. And then also you have, in reality, it's not just a triangle. You have the reporter who's into Jimmy Stewart as well. And Jimmy Stewart's focused on Katharine Hepburn. And so there's a lot, but see, we're getting towards the end where like we're about 6 years into this genre. So people are starting to take those tropes and add on top of it. Mm-hmm. So yeah, and then war comes and kind of changes everything. One I want to talk about that I was thinking about pitching, but I'm not, so I've made my decision, Ben.
Oh wow! All right, he knows what he's going to pitch.
There was the pre-show taunting here around.
Wasn't taunting.
What the pick was going to be? Well, okay. Well, we'll just let it play out.
I was unsure of what I was going to pitch, and I think the reason I'm not going to pitch this one because I want to talk about it with here. We're talking about how the change of screwball is happening in the era, and it's called To Be or Not to Be.
Hmm.
And it's I think came out in 1942, but it's still you see a couple who is going through a struggle, but it's a screwball war comedy. And there is also a love triangle as well, which basically it's Jack Benny and Carol Lombard. And Jack Benny and Carol Lombard are these two actors who were in Poland pre the invasion of Poland by Nazi Germany. And Carol Lombard is this kind of very attractive ingenue type character, but her husband is this hammy actor who has kind of gone on but still thinks themselves as classic, wonderful actor. And they're doing Hamlet in Germany while also rehearsing a play, a satire on the Nazi Germany and the Gestapo. And this is released in 1942 in the midst of war, and it feels very ahead of its time. But the To Be or Not to Be comes up because every night when Jack Benny is performing Hamlet and he does his speech To Be or Not to Be, that is a cue for a suitor of Carol Lombard to get up out of the audience and come to the back and talk to her. So every night when Jack Benny is doing, right when he starts the big famous speech of Hamlet, some guy walks out and like it just terrifies Jack Benny every night of like, I'm a terrible actor. But what happens is that in the movie, they have to, they get word that some names have been passed around from Poland, or wars come out in Poland and Nazi Germany's invaded. And they, these names have gotten out from the soldiers of their family members. And basically a spy is going to give it over to the Gestapo. And these actors who are now unemployed because of the war, now I'll have to pose as Gestapo and in some case Hitler to get these names back to where they're not put into the wrong hands of Nazi Germany. And it is just, it's very early Mel Brooks like comedy, and it's pushing the envelope of this genre because you're literally seeing it's Nazi symbols and a war breaking out in the midst of this screwball caper in a way. And it's by 42 and 43, we're beginning to like see these filmmakers playing with these tropes.
I actually never seen the original. I've only seen the remake.
Oh, you lied.
Oh no. I went back and unchecked it. I was just okay. Scanning and I saw the title and I clicked it, 'cause I have seen the remake by Mel Brooks.
Yeah. And so it's, you can see why like Mel Brooks, like, with Mel Brooks and Bancroft, his wife, they remade that film, and it's very much, it's very much a Mel Brooks film, but in 1942, and it's really kind of crazy. But Mel Brooks, again, if you want to start going into like how screwball genre changed over time after this like kind of golden age era, you have people like Mel Brooks come out and do similar films like Spaceballs, which this is a big jump, but like Spaceballs with being Bill Pullman's character, is there's a class difference between him and the princess.
Whoa, it's just, he's
taken her back to, she runs away like Claude Colbert and It Happened One Night. He has to get her and take her back to her father because he's going to get this big sum of money to do it. And they essentially, from different worlds, and they're constantly like bickering back and forth of this like sexual tension. And that's the whole oh, that's the whole story between them two, is that he has to take her back, he's gonna get money, and she's like, well, you're just in it for the money. But it's very much a screwball comedy set in space, is basically what it is, with Mel Brooks.
Directed by Mel Brooks.
I gotta add that to the list, guys. That's not currently on there.
No, we didn't think to put that one on the Letterboxd list.
I was thinking about it before, like, we started recording. I was like, it kind of fits. And now, in the midst of us talking about it and breaking down these trips, it very much fits in that genre. So Thomas, we talked about some films. How does the transition start? Like, what starts happening? And what are some other films that come out post this era?
Well, I think one thing, like we were talking about with the Hitchcock, is once people started figuring out how to get around the code, even before the code was done, once people started figuring out how to get around the code, you could actually show people making out. You could really dive more into romance without having to be tongue-in-cheek about it. So I think that's where you start to lose a lot of the screwball comedy of it. And you really had that kind of split between romantic films and comedies. But you still continued to have some films in and out. I know Some Like It Hot is one that definitely, I think you wouldn't necessarily classify it as a rom-com because there is that romantic subplot between Tony Curtis and Marilyn Monroe. But I think when you think about the movie, I think the overall plot you think about is Tony Curtis and Jack Lemmon having to, running from the mob and drag. But there's definitely a lot of screwball influences in that movie, especially the fact that Tony Curtis is basically playing a parody of
Cary Grant.
Of Cary Grant, yeah, as his wealthy heir character that he's using to trick Marilyn Monroe. But I think what is really cited as the one film, as the years went on, the film that really kept the genre alive and might be the last true out-and-out screwball comedy was in 72 when Peter Bogdanovich, who was a huge fan of the genre, decided to do What's Up, Doc, which is just a 100% screwball comedy. And it was basically a remake of Bringing Up Baby. You have this, you have Ryan O'Neal as this extremely bookish nerd geologist character who is on a trip with his overbearing fiance and bumps into Barbara Streisand, who is very headstrong, pretty quirky woman who just decides, I like this guy, I'm gonna win him over, I'm gonna make him mine. And just all of the crazy antics that they get into with her pursuing him. And actually, I just looked right now, the tagline for What's Up, Doc was a screwball comedy, remember them.
Yeah, that's pretty on the nose, but...
Yeah, obviously they had been dead for a while
by
1972 when that one came out.
Can we jump back just a little bit? Because we've got the list is chronological, or I guess I sorted by chronological release. One of the films that I have seen that I'm curious to see how you guys feel like it fits is... It's a Mad, 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 Mad World is on this list. I don't think of it as like a rom-com, and it's definitely a comedy, but I'm trying to think through like what are the reasons you guys think that it fits as a screwball comedy?
I'm going to be real. I haven't seen the movie.
Oh no, Brandon, what? We got to shut the podcast down right now. This never happens.
Wow. Put me on the spot here. I mean, I think, and we're going to start to get into this now that we've kind of established that the genre didn't really persist past.
Right. Exactly.
The genre as it purely was didn't really exist past What's Up, Doc? Is that you can, the thing is, it's such an influential genre. I mean, it is one of the earliest genres that you can point to and say, you know, that is a specific film genre, kind of like film noir. You can point to when it started, and you can point to when it ended, and you can point to all of the influence it has had since then. And I think in Mad, 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 Mad World, you're looking at that super snappy dialogue. You're looking at a whole lot of, not necessarily opposites attract, but the comedy that can be derived from throwing a bunch of people who are very different from each other together. and just kind of the hectic pace of it all too, because that's something that bringing a baby kind of brought in early is just like a totally breathless pace for a comedy.
The film is crazy. We watched it a lot when I was growing up, and then I got it from the library a while ago and rewatched it, and the pace of it for the time, you know, I don't know, for the time, 1963, you could imagine it today, right? They did a remake, but it's not that great, but just the pace of it and the dialogue, the dialogue definitely kind of fits in to what we're talking about, and I think that gets us into as well, like the Coen brothers being mentioned as heavily influenced by Screwball, because they also have this, like, you know, kind of famous, you know, banter in a lot of their films. That we've got a couple on the list here. Raising Arizona is the first, I think, from them. But I think it's interesting to now we're kind of like, maybe we're putting the Screwball genre through like a prism and seeing how it fractures out into current films, right? Because it's slices. It's not the whole thing, but bits of it you see it scattered in other films.
But the Coens are. The Coens, I feel like, are the only people who are out here who are really making, not all of their films are pure Screwball comedies, but a lot of them are. Raising Arizona, I think, is as close to a Screwball comedy as you can get in the modern era. You've got very obvious opposites attract. You've got a police officer and a career criminal as a couple who do this extremely bizarre out there, you know, break into a rich man's house and steal one of it was octuplets and take one of the octuplets and then just get into absolute craziest. I mean, you've got a motorcycle riding bounty hunter boogeyman that's chasing them down. It's farcical. It's all romantic still, and the dialogue is super fast paced. Intolerable Cruelty is another one that I think is trying very hard to be a Screwball comedy. Not one of their more successful films, but you've got a very strong woman and a kind of dumb guy who is just being totally strung along by her in a very cynical look at love, which I think Clooney is one of the best. There's been several films Clooney's been in where he, and especially in the Coen brothers films, that he's a very good stand-in for Cary Grant in the way that he's extremely good looking, but he can pull off dopey, he can pull off smug. And the Coen brothers have definitely recognized that, and in a lot of the films they've put him in.
Yeah, I mean, Hail Caesar is one of my favorite, where he's a moron, he's a total idiot. And we've got it on the list, and I think so. Let's split this out if we can. I don't know how to.
Can I make a comment about Raising Arizona real quick? I just want to jump in, because we in my comedy class in college and undergrad, we actually talked about Raising Arizona and how it fits in this model. But it's actually like, it's basically, our professor pitched it as, it's a romantic comedy about, that tells a story about after the romantic comedy ends. So basically, if you watch Beginning of Raising Arizona, you see how they meet, how they get together, you see that dynamic of their, like, he is this felon who keeps getting arrested, and Holly Hunter is the person who takes his mugshots every time. And so, for like the first 13 minutes, it's this long prologue that's basically just a condensed romantic comedy of how they get together. And then literally at 13-minute mark, that's when the titles start, or about that moment, that's when the title starts, and you're seeing the afterwards of the romantic comedy, which is kind of just a Screwball version where they're now together and they have this new challenge they have to do, and so it just gets very, like Tom was saying, it's very farcical. But yeah, I just wanted to jump in and say that, Ben, continue with what you're saying.
No, but that was what I was going to get at, is this idea of farce, right? Like it seems like most of these modern films that we have on the list, like we're basically calling out, you know, sort of that farcical element. I mean, I think the Coen brothers in particular, right? But for example, we also have They Came Together, on the list. I'm trying to think of, like, you know, what other, you have satire and you have farce, and I'm not going to try and parse the difference of those, like, off the top of my head. But, like, I'm just thinking.
Farce has like a lot of shutting doors. That's what Farce has. A lot of shutting doors is what I was told in theater.
Oh, interesting.
Like it's very weird. It was like noises off. So noises off, for example, if anyone knows, is considered a farce and like one of the greatest of like modern theater or whatever, or American theater. And there's just a lot of slamming doors. That's what they're like saying. Oh, that's what a farce is. Every farce has to have a bunch of slamming doors. And What's Up, Doc also has that, by the way, where they're like going down the hallway and everyone's like running and like they don't know what room they're going to or whatever. Is that like I'm blanking on?
Well, there's like three different suitcases that all hold different things, and everybody's mixed up all the suitcases. And there's a extended sequence where people are going into different rooms trying to get the right suitcase.
A lot of slamming doors and farces, guys. Sorry, continue.
I feel like farce has some sort of suspension of reality, not as much as a satire. But a farce definitely has that suspension of reality, which if we're going through this list we put together, where it kind of splits off and you have a lot of elements of the screwball comedy, but you lose that kind of farce and you lose that cynical nature, is around the late 90s, early 2000s, which some may call the golden age of modern rom-coms. I think really ushered in by You've Got Mail, where that opposites attract part aspect of a rom-com is just everywhere. You've got Mail, we've got 2 weeks Notice on here, How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days, Down with Love, all that kind of stuff where these two people come together and it's cliche at this point, but it was done extremely well. Then was like, oh, these two people hate each other, they're never gonna fall in love. And you still get a lot of that banter in these films, and a lot of them are still very smart, maybe not necessarily that cynical nature that you had in the early screwball comedies, but still very smart and definitely the banter back and forth.
Yeah, and with You Got Mail and even like, so with You've Got Mail, 2 weeks Notice, and even How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days, it's taking some of those tropes from screwball comedy. So with You've Got Mail, you have this literal class struggle where Meg Ryan is middle class, owns a mom and pop bookstore, and this big business guy, Tom Hanks, is coming and opening up like essentially a Barnes & Noble right across the street to put her out of business. Like, it's
interestingly not an aspect of the original. You know, You've Got Mail is based on Shop Around the Corner, and that class difference isn't an aspect of the original. No. They're both working basically the same job. I mean, Jimmy Stewart is her manager, but he's not any richer than she is. So that's something that was introduced for this one.
Yeah, that's more of a traditional romantic comedy in a way. It's a Shop Around the Corner, and this is like you have that struggle. With 2 weeks Notice, it's the same thing where Hugh Grant is this rich, almost like kind of idiotic brother or idiotic character who is the president or whatever this main company, and he's just kind of the face of it because he's the charming British guy, and he hires Sandra Bullock to be his assistant, and she like hates everything he stands for. Or with How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days, it's the battle of the sexes, is that she's trying to, like, I can't remember what the premise, it's like she's trying to lose him in 10 days.
They're both journalists, which is a huge journalism and screwball comedies go hand in hand almost. She's a writer who's writing about how you can get a guy to break up with you in 10 days. And he's writing an article about how to get a girl to fall in love with you in 10 days. Yeah. So they're both kind of have these ulterior motives when they come together in this relationship.
Do you think that connection into journalism is used as a sort of shorthand way to explain the witty banter of the characters? Basically, it's like this explains why these people are hyper intelligent and like going after each other like this. Is there?
And it's wordplay. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. The wordplay aspect, basically.
Yeah. I think that's very,
I mean, because You've Got Mail, they're booksellers. I mean, that's basically parallel of journalism, right? Mm-hmm. It's like,
and they're corresponding. I mean, they're both very passionate about writing long emails. If you can be passionate about
And, or even like break it down, like even go a different way, but with lawyers, for example, like you have A Terrible Cruelty. Mm-hmm. He's a divorce lawyer, and My Cousin Vinny is one we haven't talked about, but like he is a lawyer that's defending these two people, and his wife or girlfriend, Miss Tomei, is very much equal on when it comes to intelligence. And it's literally, he's using words in a certain way with his job. So these are usually very dialogue heavy, and it's a good way to point out that their jobs deal with this in some way.
Which I gotta jump in and I asked about this at the beginning. Silver Lining Playbook we put on
here.
Okay,
yeah.
Let's break this one down because I see that more as like definitely like a drama with. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not a rom-com, but it's a romance, you know. Yeah. So it's opposites attract, I guess, right? That's the screwball aspect that we're gonna say.
And they're both unconventional.
Yeah.
And she's an extremely strong. There's so many scenes that Jennifer Lawrence's character just dominates in a way that you would think of Katharine Hepburn. There's a scene I absolutely love where they've not been allowed to practice dancing on game days because Bradley Cooper's dad has to have him in the house wearing his jersey on game days, and has said that Jennifer Lawrence's character is bad luck. And there's this one scene where she comes storming into the house and just points down Robert De Niro and lists off all the times that they've been practicing and how the football team has won every single time that they've been practicing during a game. And Robert De Niro just has this moment where he goes, okay, yeah, I like her. I have to say I like her. And it's a scene straight out of Bringing Up Baby or What's Up, Doc. Jennifer Lawrence absolutely dominates that movie, and there's so many times when you can just look at Bradley Cooper and see that he's way over his head.
Yeah,
but it's interesting. Brandon and I added that to the list after I found a conversation thread on Reddit where somebody posted kind of the idea that Silver Linings Playbook is a screwball comedy with real modern people cast in it.
Yeah.
And his term was like revisionist screwball comedy.
Yeah, and I think that a couple of other films that we pulled that kind of have that extremely strong female character, and it's not just saying, oh wow, it's a strong female. It is someone who just completely dominates the film, and you can just see them actively dragging the male lead along with them through this thing and into situations that they would not be comfortable with otherwise. A couple that we pulled, oddly enough, Ben Stiller has done this very well at least twice in my book. Along Came Polly is one that we pulled, where he is a super uptight businessman who meets a friend from high school that he used to have a crush on, and she is now a very bohemian free spirit and just completely takes him out of his comfort zone through the whole film. And I texted this one to Brandon like two nights ago.
Yeah, this is
what
I was going to ask about because I'm like, okay, break this down, Thomas, on the podcast.
I think he thought I was crazy, but I just texted him, yo, Night at the Museum 2 is a screwball comedy. But
Battle of the Smithsonian, guys.
Well, it came to me because I was thinking about modern actresses who I've seen play this kind of Katharine Hepburn-type character, and I could see Amy Adams doing it in my head. I could see Amy Adams channeling Katharine Hepburn, and I couldn't think of what movie it was. And then all of a sudden it dawned on me, it was Night at the Museum 2 with her as Amelia Earhart. And funnily enough, I've told a couple people about this since then, and they're like, oh man, Ben Stiller's so bland. Like, Ben Stiller didn't do anything in those movies. And that's like the point, at least in the second one. He's cowardly. He's already been through it once in this one, but he still doesn't like want anything to do with all these museum pieces coming to life. And she, if you go back and watch that movie, she's delightful, but she is like so excited for the chance to go on an adventure, and she's dragging him everywhere and just absolutely dominating the night. It is 100%. If you go back and watch that movie, there's so much of the spirit of Bringing a Baby in that film.
Yeah, that was one thing that also you touched on that was another big kind of, not trope, but thing, was that it was always this woman who was able to bring this man out of his comfort zone and, like, take him on adventures. And not in a way where, like, she inspired him and, like, he became, like, above her. It was like, no, it would take her on these adventures as an equal.
It's together. I mean, I think dragging is a great, if you watch Bringing Up Baby, it is dragging. And hopefully by the end, he becomes... he becomes up to the task. But I don't think in What's Up, Doc, when you get to the end of it, I don't think Ryan O'Neal would choose to relive that day. He survived it, and he appreciates Barbra Streisand for bringing him through it. But They rise to the occasion, but they don't even necessarily change that much.
Yeah, and I just realized it because I haven't seen it in a while. But would you classify Something Wild by Jonathan Demme in this category?
Yeah,
because it's like Melanie Griffith is this like kind of free spirited person who like basically rips Jeff Daniels out of his like mundane life and takes him on this wild adventure mm-hmm. that he is like not prepared for at all.
Yeah, for sure. All right, I have two more modern ones I want to talk about before we finish up, because if people come look at our letterbox list, which everyone should, because there's some really cool, it's a really cool database for the genres we're talking about. Mm-hmm. But there's two interesting ones I think people might see and be a little confused at. One is Wedding Crashers. but just I think a lot of the things we've talked about, that class difference, that men kind of being pulled completely out of their comfort zones, and there's a lot of very strong female characters in Wedding Crashers. Isla Fisher is definitely one who could just kind of is extremely more than meets
dominates the eye. Dominates Vince Vaughn basically.
Vince Vaughn has absolutely no idea, completely defies his expectations, but ends up like completely, you know, dominating his weekend. But it's so, the movie is so much about these two guys who are just kind of schmucks who think they know how the weekend's gonna go, and then just end up way over their heads in this class, this upper class island that is, you know, they're not prepared for whatsoever. And another one I want to talk about was Set It Up, which is the most recent film on our list. Mm-hmm. Netflix is very charming rom-com from this year.
Underappreciated, I feel like. I think like it's fared well, but it's one that like not many people went and like ventured out to see, it feels like.
Yeah.
Isn't that true of most Netflix films?
I mean, yeah, it's like it didn't get Bird Box level, guys. Like,
yeah,
I mean,
and that Bird Box, that one got maybe too much attention.
Yeah,
that banter is there like so much, and it's a film that focuses its plot on. I mean, you know when you start it, it's not breaking any barriers. When you start watching it, you know the two characters are going to fall in love with each other, but that's not the focus of the film. The focus of the film is them setting their bosses up. So you have that kind of class difference between these two assistants who are trying to control the lives of these two people who are extremely higher status than them. And you have a ton of witty banter. And there is, I mean, they end up together and it's a happy ending, but there is still that kind of cynical.
There is, yeah.
It's very real. It's not, it doesn't feel that like glowy Hollywood kind of love. It's two people who become friends through this and then realize that they should be together.
Yeah, because they're going to fall in love, but the premise of the story is not, they could theoretically not fall in love by the end of this movie and it'd still be the same movie, if that makes sense. Like,
yeah,
it's like,
exactly. The two of them grow independently.
Like the whole concept is to set up their bosses and they just fall for each other in the process. It's not my top 10 of last year, but that was like one of my like underappreciated films of last year, and probably one of Netflix's best from last year, guys.
So it's really cool. I'm sure there's so many other modern films that we haven't thought of, and I'd love for anybody listening to let us know what you think of. But that's something that's really cool when you start looking at genres like this, like film noir, that have been around for so long and aren't necessarily around in the purest form. But when you can look back at a movie like It Happened One Night, like Bringing Up Baby, like His Girl Friday, and see how that genre did exist in its purest form, then you can really start to see just how completely it has, even though it's kind of quote unquote gone now, it's actually just kind of dissipated into all these other genres. Yeah. And there's pieces of it everywhere.
Yeah. So I think that calls for our Time to Pitch Ben move, our Time to Pitch Ben segment.
Da 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 da.
Thomas, and let you go first with this.
Ooh.
One.
Oh.
Oh.
Yeah.
The
privilege and the benefit.
Oh, man. Okay. All right. I'm not going to second guess myself. I do kind of want to go back. The other film I was thinking about pitching, I thought was going to come up in the episode, and that was Arsenic and Old Lace. It didn't come up in the episode, but I'm gonna stick with my decision. I'm not going to go back. I do highly recommend that film. It is a...
Another Cary Grant one.
And we were talking about kind of the idea of the farce. I feel like that one is a little bit higher level farce than most screwball comedies. I mean, it's extremely twisted especially for the time period. It's about Cary Grant brings his fiance home to meet the two little old ladies who raised him and finds out that they've been murdering people and burying them in the basement. And it's great.
Also a Frank Capra movie as well.
Yeah. Very twisted, but a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. But that's not what I'm going to pitch. Everyone should watch it, but that's not what I'm going with. Ben, I bring to you today, I'm double checking that you haven't seen it yet. Okay. I bring to you today the 2009 classic, The Proposal.
From a list of classics, let's go ahead and put it on the table. The number of these films that I've seen, there's 67 films on this list at the time that we're recording. I've seen 11. So 16%. And you go, I'm here. I'm in this. Let's do it.
I told Brandon I wanted to try to pitch you a newer one because we had all those classics on there, but I wanted to go. Wanted to go newer. Okay, it's 2009. It's honestly a little bit after the heyday of the modern rom com. You know, you haven't had. I view Fool's Gold as the death of the modern rom com.
Oh, wow.
No offense to Matthew McConaughey or Kate Hudson, but that's when it became just apparent that studios thought if you put two good-looking people together in a stupid plot, everyone would still go see it, and everyone realized how bad it was. But this is a little bit after the death of the modern rom-com, which was Sandra Bullock's bread and butter at the time. This is pre-Gravity Sandra Bullock. and this is also pre-Deadpool Ryan Reynolds. So very different time period for both of these actors. But Sandra Bullock is a all business book publisher who has no friends. Everybody hates her. And Ryan Reynolds is her assistant who absolutely despises her, but puts up with it because he thinks that she's going to eventually let him work his way up in the company. So Sandra Bullock, who is Canadian, is told that her green card is up and she has to leave the country. So she forces Ryan Reynolds, her assistant, to pose as her fiance so that she can get citizenship in America. So he ends up at the order of the immigration office. They say, well, doesn't she need to go meet your parents? So he flies her off to Alaska to introduce her to his family, which includes Mary Steenburgen and Craig T. Nelson as her parents and Betty White as his grandmother. And so, you know, the basic rom-com stuff happens. These two people who absolutely hate each other end up learning to love each other after spending like a couple weeks in Alaska together. But Sandra Bullock learns to be a better person. She really finds the family she never had in his family. But there is a lot of really fun stuff that it's original. It is your basic rom-com plot, but there is some very original, funny moments painted in there. Like Betty White and Sandra Bullock dancing around a campfire together, or Oscar from The Office as the local stripper. he just like lives in town and just strips for this little Alaskan town of women.
Oh man.
Thank you, Brandon. This is really hard. We're doing this. This is a hard pitch. We're doing this without video today, and I have no way of reading Ben's reactions to these things I'm pitching. I have no way of knowing how I'm doing this.
This is as the audience gets to experience. They don't know what I'm thinking. No one does.
But yes, I mean, Betty White is great. I feel like this was kind of the beginning of the resurgence of Betty White.
Yeah.
I think this was probably around the same time as Hot in Cleveland started on TV.
Well, and don't forget that Snickers commercial. That was the big one.
Oh, okay. That's... Okay. Well, we're not here to debate that. Betty White is wonderful in this film. But Ryan Reynolds, incredibly great comic timing, great mugging. He has that kind of sarcastic banter that works for screwball comedy that a lot of people have lost in modern era. He's got that kind of smirk and that quick, he's quick with his lines, and that I think that's what has made him so popular, something like Deadpool, But it the whole thing, as for having Ryan Reynolds there, I think the whole film is given this kind of cynical nature that makes it not quite, that makes it a little step above your average rom-com. It's a little bit smarter and it's a little bit edgier, but I'm not gonna pretend it's anything more than a studio rom-com. But if you're watching one for your money, this one's mm-hmm. a very fun one to watch. It's on FX like constantly. I don't know if it's streaming anywhere, but Ben, it's worth checking out. And like I've said, one of the most interesting things about the screwball genre is to be able to see where it's come in recent times. And so I urge you to pick this film as your way of appreciating the genre and what it has become and how has it affected modern filmmaking. Thank you.
The more we can stick to this format of I come before you today and also backing away slowly from the throne and saying thank you, yes, I appreciate your pitch and your earnesty. I'll tell you this, Brandon may not have predicted this comment from me. Mary Steen Bergen,
mm-hmm.
Great.
Oh, yeah.
Super great. Back to the Future 3, that was like, she was the coolest. She was the coolest. We watched that movie all the time growing up. So I'm going to give you, these aren't worth anything, but these are bonus points for that alone. Just that aspect. You.
Quick little plug here. If you ever find yourself driving through Little Rock, Arkansas, the Arkansas Film Museum is at the State House, and there's a whole room devoted to Mary Steen Bergen. It's wonderful.
Really?
There's not that many famous people from Arkansas.
And also Jeff Nichols, Ben. So.
Yeah, there's a Jeff Nichols room too.
Are you kidding me?
Yeah. We're field trip to Arkansas, guys.
I used to drive through Little Rock all the time, and I did not know that.
I'm going to go the opposite way with this pitch. Going back to the year is 1934.
Ew, that movie probably doesn't even have color, Ben. Gross.
Okay, dear God. Oh, man. So, 1934. The movie is The Thin Man. Adaptation of the Dashiell Hammett novel, The Thin Man. And it stars William Powell and Myrna Loy as the famous Nick and Nora Charles. And Nick is this retired detective in New York who married Nora. And Nora is this like wealthy heiress, which is very prevalent in a lot of the early screwball comedy genre or comedy films. And he always jokes that he married her for his money, playing on that idea of like heiress marrying poor. And he's a retired detective and is basically drinks most of the day and drinks all the night. And an old friend of his goes missing and his daughter comes to him asking him to take the case and come out of retirement to investigate what happened to her father. And Nora is very much an equal with Nick and she's always constantly trying to get him back into the detective game because she also like wants to be a detective as well. And the dialogue is amazing between these two. The mystery is, it's very much, it's like a film noir. It sits in the film noir genre as well, but it's a film noir with a screwball comedy where there's murder happening. People are going missing. There's money being like finding out where the money's going. And in the middle is this like William Powell, like sarcastic, witty character who's always drinking. And Nora is always there by his side and basically trying to jump in and add her two cents to everything. And she's always like, she always has a comeback to his comment and she usually wins out most of the time. And basically it's nominated for Best Picture back in 1934. It came out the same year as It Happened One Night. So it's very much this one of the more influential screwball comedy genres. It doesn't really fit into the typical tropes we talked about, but it's one of the most screwball comedy like tone, like feeling movies you'll probably see because the dialogue is so amazing. Roger Ebert said the William Powell is to dialogue as Fred Astaire is to dance.
Ebert, get after it.
William Powell is like Thin Man is like one of my favorite films because like the dialogue is amazing and it's one that holds up even today when you watch it. And it feels so like they're a married couple, and like I think another critic said, Andrew Sarah said, Nick and Nora were the first on-screen Hollywood couple for whom matrimony did not signal the end of sex, romance, and adventure. The mystery doesn't matter. It's just these two characters and two actors are so entertaining together. I think Myrna Loy and Wim Powell made like 16 to 20 films together or something like that. They made, I think, 6 Thin Man movies. And it's just the chemistry. They're one of the best duos of all time. That's what I'm bringing you, Ben. I hope you enjoy it. It's a wonderful film. Good night.
I knew you were skirting around that one. When we were discussing, I was like, I gave you several opportunities to talk about that one, and I was like, Brandon's not talking about the Thin Man in the episode.
Oh my gosh. The more you guys can build up this this rivalry, like opposites that don't attract, you know what I mean? And you hate each other, and then slowly over the course of all these episodes, you're gonna realize that you're perfect for each other. All right, so here is a curveball to this whole thing that neither of you could have anticipated before this pitch. Moments before coming in to do the podcast, I was having this very Portland thing, brunch with some friends.
Mm, yes, brunch.
We brunch very, here on the weekends.
Very Portland.
It's very unique to the region. Anyway, someone brought up this whole Thin Man film series. I was loosely talking about the topic for today, and they're like, have you seen the Thin Man? We watch that all the time. Brandon,
who'd you pay off?
Right. Who did you pay off? This feels like an improbable series of events. Brandon, other bonus points, bringing quotes from Ebert. You're like,
okay. All right. 1 second. Let me, Brandon may have brought up the Thin Man's 4 Academy Award nominations, but I would like to note that the proposal was nominated for 4 MTV Movie Awards, including Sandra Bullock and Ryan Reynolds for Best Comedic Performances, Ryan Reynolds for Best Kiss, and Betty White for Best WTF Moment.
Were they also nominated for the Blockbuster Awards that were that year, or was that already out of business by then?
It won Best Dance at the Teen Choice Awards.
It did, yeah.
Wow. Gentlemen, I think, as always, delicate decision, complicated and heated debate. I gotta go with the Thin Man. I gotta see this.
Oh,
if
man.
This is gonna be the greatest pairing.
I feel cheated. Brandon withheld his decision, and I would have gone for something.
No. I told you a few days ago I was looking at the Thin Man, and I wasn't for sure yet. Like,
okay.
You got a heads up. You got a heads up. I gave you more heads up than you gave me today, okay? Like, you didn't tell me the proposal until we were in the middle of the show.
That's because I was going to do Along Came Polly, and then Ben had already seen it. If I had Philip Seymour Hoffman in my court...
Yeah, that's true.
So it's 3-2. I'm in the lead, finally.
All right. Oh, my
I'm
gosh.
Back next time with a vengeance.
You see, Thomas, you fell for the trap. You went with Ryan Reynolds, and for some reason, Ben does not like Ryan Reynolds.
Ryan Reynolds is the only actor to have been brought up twice in our pitches.
He is 0-2 on
this
show.
Also making him the only actor to have lost twice in our pitches.
He's 0-2. Oh, man.
I feel like there were some clues that I've given. You know, I've given out some...
Ben, why do you hate Ryan Reynolds?
You
know, in a choice between a good movie and a Ryan Reynolds movie, I'll choose
Oh, man. We might have to end this show. I think we
need to send this to Ryan Reynolds.
Yeah, I mean, I would have loved for Ryan Reynolds to come on here and talk to Ben for a few
minutes. Come at me, Ryan Reynolds.
All right. I think that's it. That's a great delve into the screwball genre, and we're probably just like scratching the surface.
It's entirely subjective as to where you see the genre these days. So that's something we'd love to get some feedback on. Is what's your favorite kind of modern take on the genre or on the tropes that were introduced by the genre?
Definitely.
Yeah, guys, thank you for listening. Make sure you follow us on iTunes, follow us on Spotify, and make sure you give us a rating. A review. We love hearing what you guys have to say because we want to kind of continue doing this. And send us your thoughts through Twitter at Cinnation Show. Like us on Facebook. Please rant to Ben about your hatred for him hating Ryan Reynolds.
Yeah, come at me.
At Sweet22 is what he's at.
Yep, SUITE 22. And you can tell me why I'm an idiot.
Yeah. So, guys, thank you for listening. Hope you listen to more episodes soon. Bye.